DW Africa Link.
It's Thursday, the 24th of October, 2019. A very warm welcome to Africa Link, coming to you live from our studio here in Bonn, Germany. Here's where you get all the updates from Africa and beyond. I am Eddie Micah Jr.
And I am Michael Luti. Remember to join the discussion on today's topics via our Facebook page, DW Africa. Coming up on the show, a nuclear power plant by Russia is expected to be completed in Zambia to help solve the country's power crisis, but critics are calling out against it.
It requires a massive investment into it for more than 15, 20 years or even 100 years. Most of the countries who are developed actually are running away from the use of nuclear energy.
Also coming up, a Kenyan software expert and entrepreneur has just received the 2019 German Africa Award for her positive contribution to society. She says,
I'm very grateful. It means a lot to me, but I think it also means a lot to young men and women who may see a clip or a picture.
All these stories coming up shortly.
Yes, indeed. The details right after the news in brief.
DW News.
I'm Kai Dambach with the DW News. Ethiopian activist Jawar Mohammed called for calm on Thursday after 16 people were killed in protests throughout the country. Hundreds of his supporters set up camp around his house overnight. The protests are seen as a litmus test for Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed, as it could embolden regional leaders, but violence would tarnish his reformist credentials and recently awarded Nobel Peace Prize. Meanwhile, Ethiopia and Egypt have agreed to resume technical discussions on a dam project. The project, which is already under construction on Ethiopia's Blue Nile, has caused a diplomatic dispute between the two countries. Russian President Vladimir Putin said he would be willing to help mediate the conflict between the two countries. Former Spanish leader Francisco Franco's body was exhumed from a mausoleum to be buried in a discreet place closer to Madrid. One of Franco's family members was opposed to the move.
He's the history of Spain, whether you like it or not. And as a Catholic, they are not allowing my family to bury him where we want. And secondly, not allowing mass for a dead person, and they are profaning a tomb.
Por un muerto, te están profanando una tumba.
Spain's acting Prime Minister Pedro Sánchez said exhuming Franco was a step towards reconciliation. Franco led a far-right dictatorship from 1939 until his death in 1975. This news comes to you from Deutsche Welle, Germany's international public broadcaster. Bolivian President Evo Morales declared victory on Thursday in his country. Morales received 46.85% of the vote, while centrist Carlos Mesa has 36.68% with less than 2% of votes left uncounted. A margin of at least 10 percentage points is needed to avoid a runoff. Morales said he was open to holding a runoff if necessary. Morales's critics, as well as the European Union, Brazil, and the United States, have expressed concern over how the votes were tallied. Lebanon's president, Michel Aoun, said Thursday that he was ready to speak with protesters to determine the best way forward for the country.
My call to demonstrators, I am ready to meet your representatives that carry your concerns, to listen to your specific demands. You will hear from us about your fears over financial collapse. We will discuss what we can do together to achieve your objectives without causing collapse and chaos.
Anti-corruption protests have clogged streets throughout the country for the past week. The protests appear that they will continue, as banks stated they will remain closed on Friday. A court in Bangladesh has sentenced 16 people to death in relation to the murder of a student. The student was murdered after she refused to withdraw her sexual harassment complaint against the head teacher of the seminary that she attended. The defense lawyer said that he will fight against the sentence in the higher courts. For more news and information, please visit our website at dw.com. I'm Kai Dambach.
If you've just joined us, this is DW Africa Link, coming to you live from our studios here in Bonn, Germany. I am Michael Luti.
And I am Eddie Micah Jr. As always, join the debate on today's stories via our Facebook page, DW Africa. Talking about the page, well, Owusu Bernard, you say you're watching live from Kokodi in Abidjan. Well, you're welcome to the show. CC Bell says, hi, DW. Well, we always say hi back. CC Bell is, again, talking about the Russia topic, which we're going to be delving in a bit. So, Michael, a lot of people tuned in.
Yes, and indeed, we start off in Zambia. And in that country, Russia, which is one of the world's largest producers of nuclear energy, is trying to help Zambia fix its energy challenges. There's an agreement for Russia to build a nuclear power plant, which is expected to be completed within the next 10 to 15 years in Zambia. The Southern African country wants to add to its energy mix to cushion the current chronic power shortages, which causes up to 13 hours of darkness and power cuts.
Now, plans to increase sources of energy were made in 2015 when the country had a severe drought and economic growth reduced by 40%. So it seems that the nuclear power plant would be great for the country's future, right? But critics argue that nuclear energy will leave a huge debt for future generations. They claim the country does not have the capacity to deal with nuclear waste. For more on this, here's our very own Kathy Short.
Last year, the Zambian government and the Russian state nuclear corporation, Rosatom, signed a general contract for the construction of a center for nuclear science and technology at a cost of $30 billion. The nuclear power plant is expected to produce at least 2,000 megawatts of electricity for more than 50 years. Zambia is dependent on hydroelectric power generation, which is causing massive power cuts of up to 13 hours daily due to drought. The plan will see the two countries set up regulatory bodies and an atomic research center in the capital, followed by the construction of Zambia's first nuclear power plant. The project also includes training Zambians in atomic science and engineering, spearheaded by Rosatom. Roland Musiska is the head of the Zambian Atomic Energy Agency. He has nothing but praises for the nuclear power deal.
Then there are direct benefits. If you're going to have a smart grid, it means you can now be able to do smart education, smart energy, smart transport, smart agriculture, smart health, smart governance, smart manufacturing, smart mining. It is all those particular, because you have a digital arrangement. Then these are the direct benefits. Then there is the indirect benefits. You will see how much supply of goods and services are required, expanded tax base, increased life expectancy, increased human development, improved education. When we speak about smart, we are talking about digitizing our systems. From smart education, which essentially means that it would be possible to teach by one maths teacher to teach the whole country if you had very good internet with broadband.
But Vince Chipatuka, an energy expert, does not agree with plans to embark on nuclear energy.
It requires a massive investment into it for more than 15, 20 years or even 100 years. And what I've also seen in the recent past, insofar as nuclear energy is concerned, most of the countries who are developed actually are running away from the use of nuclear energy. They are opting to use other means such as fossil fuels, solar, for example, water, and so forth, including wind to produce power.
Chansa Bwalya, a 23-year-old student, fears for future generation safety once nuclear energy is implemented.
I think that we shouldn't rush to just meeting the need right now. What about tomorrow? And we are the young people. I have my young brothers and sisters. What will it be like for them to enjoy the environment if we start the nuclear energy now?
According to the head of the International Atomic Energy Agency Nuclear Infrastructure Development Section, Mikhail Kovachev, a successful nuclear power program requires political and popular support and national commitment of at least 100 years. South Africa is currently the only country in Africa with an operational nuclear power plant.
Kathy Short with that report.
And all around the world, nuclear energy is a controversial subject. And on our Facebook page, indeed it is. Kaspar Mbanda says that there are a lot of African intellectuals who have the skills to negotiate on our behalf to avoid a possible backlash of these deals.
Bruno Frombert adds, the fact that Russia has accepted a nuclear power deal with some African states is a positive step.
Sadu says, in his view, it is not a bad idea signing nuclear deals if Africa consider the fact that lots of rivers are dwindling.
And Joachim Odiado says, Russian partnership with Africa is far better than the partnership with the West. Now, this statement, only time will tell if
indeed,
it's a true
indeed
one or not.
No?
Okay.
All right. So we now move on to another story that is making international headlines. China's foreign ministry has confirmed reports by British police that 39 dead bodies found in a truck container near London were all Chinese nationals.
Now, the driver of the truck from Northern Ireland is still being questioned after he was arrested on suspicion of murder, but no charges have been brought against him yet. Investigations are ongoing, and Britain's National Crime Agency says it is working to find out whether organised crime groups are involved. DW's Thomas Amta has more.
It's Britain's largest murder investigation in years. Police are still trying to piece together what happened to the 39 bodies found in this truck. It's also a tragedy which has touched many in this community.
I'm completely and utterly shocked and devastated that that's actually happened here today, especially in this area. I mean, my mum only works down the road, my dad works down there, so this is the area that I drive down all the time. So for that to happen, I'm completely shocked.
Detectives want to know the exact route the truck took on its way to the industrial park on the outskirts of East London. British police are facing an Europe-wide investigation. It's known the lorry has Bulgarian number plates and passed through the port of Zeebrugge in Belgium. The truck's driver was from Northern Ireland. Forensic investigations are long underway, but police say the victims are Chinese nationals, 8 women and 31 men. Late Wednesday, officers towed away the truck. For now, there are still more questions than clear answers in this grim case, which has horrified many Britons.
Thomas Amta with that report. And the award goes to...
I think I deserve it. Me?
No, not you, Michael, really. It's Juliana Rotich from Kenya. She was presented with the German Africa Award on Wednesday by the German Chancellor herself, Angela Merkel.
Oh, yes, indeed. Juliana Rotich is from Kenya and a co-founder of software project Ushahidi. The software was introduced to monitor violence in Kenya after the 2007 general elections got marred in violence.
Now, Ushahidi is a Swahili word that means testimony. It began in Kenya as an internet platform developed to map reports of post-election violence and has now revolutionized the international flow of data and information.
A well-deserved award indeed. German Chancellor Angela Merkel had nothing but praise for her after presenting the award.
Inspiration und Motivation bieten vor allem Vorbilder.
Above all, inspiration and motivation provide role models like Ms. Rottich. Your success encourages many other women. They show what and how much one can do with good ideas and determination, economically, socially, and beyond national borders. We need people like you who have the courage to innovate and thereby infect others.
Die Mut für Neues haben und damit dann auch andere anstecken.
That was German Chancellor Angela Merkel.
Very powerful words there indeed. Well, after receiving the prestigious award, Juliana gave this acceptance speech.
It honors and sheds a light as to the potential in digital economies in places that you wouldn't expect digital economies to exist. So I'm very grateful. It means a lot to me, but I think it also means a lot to young men and women who may see a clip or a picture.
That was Juliana Rotich, 2019 German Africa Prize winner.
And you know, a 16-member independent jury headed by our very own Klaus Stecker, head of DW Africa Programs, selected Rotich from a list of 18 African nominees.
Yes, indeed. Clearly a job well done by the jury. Rotich stood out not only for her business achievements and technological innovations, but also for her outstanding sense of social responsibility. Okay, so congratulations to her. Well deserved. When are you getting an award, Michael?
Well, I thought this was for me, but obviously it's not. I'm going to work harder.
We'll wait for you, Michael. This is Africa Link. Stay tuned.
If you've just joined us, this is Africa Link, coming to you live from our studios here in Bonn, Germany. I am Michael Luti.
And I am Eddie Micah Jr. Don't forget to join the discussion on our Facebook page, DW Africa. It's hot. Everyone is giving their point of view, so do drop yours there.
Coming up in the next 15 minutes, Burundian authorities detained five journalists for reporting on clashes between security forces and gunmen.
Currently, reporting in Burundi is not that easy because in most cases, you have to sometimes censor yourself.
We'll get into that story in a bit. But talking about journalists, let's first head to Sierra Leone, where many journalists still face abuse. Last month, two female sports journalists were assaulted by members of the Presidential Guard while running commentary at a football game.
Following that incident, a committee was set up to look into the incident and has recommended that the security men be removed from their post. Here's a report by DW correspondent Claudia Anthony from Sierra Leone.
I was seriously kicked on my back. My phone's taken away from me. My bag got missing.
That was Esther Marie Samura, a sports journalist with the Sierra Leone Broadcasting Corporation, narrating the ordeal she suffered at the hands of President Julius Maada Bio's guards. Samura and her colleague Francis Bernard Bundo were assaulted while covering a game between Sierra Leone and Liberia at the Siaka Stevens Stadium in Freetown. The Presidential Guard demanded they vacated the commentary box because they would disturb the president. A committee set up to look into the incident has recommended that the guards be penalized. For Samura, she hopes her personal items will be found.
There are recommendations in the reports that all of those things are expected to be returned to me, as well as support me for further medication. I hope the government will look into that report and ensure that they work towards that.
The committee has recommended, among other things, the two guards be prosecuted in a bid to deter others from trampling on the rights of journalists. The recommendations have so far gone down well with Sierra Leoneans.
Personally, I feel satisfied with the recommendations that the committee have come out with, and I hope that those in authority will act upon these recommendations so that things as such do not occur again.
I think it's a fantastic decision. I believe journalists union deserves better, and if such precedents are being set, people will know that journalists are not just people you should just treat anyhow. These were just recommendations made. So we hope that all those involved in this committee will at least do follow up to ensure that the recommendations will be adhered to the letter.
The National Body of Journalists backed the two journalists in getting redress. But although the Sierra Leone Association of Journalists, SLAJ, is pleased with the outcome of the investigation, there is genuine concern regarding the realization of the recommendations, as Asmiuba explains. He is the Secretary General of the Journalist Association.
Based on the recommendations that we've seen so far, I can say SLAJ is pleased with them for now. Our only concern now is for the implementation of the recommendations, because this is not the first time an investigative committee had been established, but the outcome had been left to gather dusts on shelves. Shortly from now, we shall come out with a press release urging the government to make sure that the recommendations that have been made by this committee should be speedily implemented.
That report was by DW correspondent Claudia Anthony, and this goes to the heart of press freedom issues across Africa.
Definitely. I mean, no one should be maltreated, beaten up, disrespected, no matter what. Journalists are just out there doing their job. And DW, of course, we stand against any sort of brutality of any kind against journalists. So, yeah, let's hope that this does not keep occurring in the future, because that's quite a challenge across, isn't it?
Indeed. Indeed it is.
U-Zone.
Today on U-Zone, again, we were talking about journalists and, many different challenges face journalists, it seems. On U-Zone, DW's very own Mimi Mefo has been denied entry visa by Australian authorities for fears that she may stay in that country. Mimi's story is a reflection of a larger problem of unwarranted visa denials, especially for Africans.
This is a second denial in 2 months for Mimi Mefo, who was expected to speak at a conference in Brisbane this weekend. Earlier, I spoke to her about the incident, and I began by asking her how she felt about that decision.
I applied for the Australian visa 2 months ago. The first time it was denied, and I understood with my host in Australia organizing the Integrity 20 conference, we understood that possibly it was because of my status here in Germany, because by that time I was an intern here at Deutsche Welle. Deutsche Welle went out of its way, extended my contract, contacted German authorities, and I had to go to the German embassy where I got my visa extended. I got my contract as well extended, and now a journalist at Deutsche Welle. So we decided I have all the documents, I have all what it takes to travel anywhere around the world when I want and then come back, because Germany is where I am based now. There is no way I will have to betray this confidence and go stay in another country illegally. That is how we had to reapply again, this time with the help of an immigration expert. And the visa was again denied with the same terms, the same words from the Australian embassy here in Berlin.
And how do you feel about the decision to deny you?
Well, I feel that it has nothing to do with my status in Germany. I have a good job. I'm comfortable at Deutsche Welle. I have an address and I have a bank account. So I see that this is just press censorship.
In what ways do you think this is press censorship?
Because of what I was going to do in Australia. Did the officials at the embassy take time to go through my documents and see what I was going to do? I wasn't going there for holidays. I wasn't going there for picnic. I wasn't going there for leisure, Michael. It was a connecting flight between Brisbane, Australia to South Africa, where I was supposed to be giving the keynote or the key address at the African Investigative Journalism Conference.
Do you think this has got anything with the fact that you are African from Cameroon?
Certainly, Michael. There's always this stereotype ideas that Africans would be coming here maybe to start seeking asylum or maybe wanting to stay here more, and they would be a burden to the government. But I have been to the US, I have been to Norway, I've been to the UK, I've been to France, I'm here in Germany, where I was well received and welcomed. And if I was attending this conference, it was to talk about my experience as an engaged reporter in Cameroon. It was to talk about press freedom in the country and within the African context, especially when there's a crisis like what is going on now in Cameroon. And it was to talk about those young journalists. There are many young journalists and researchers who would love to visit Cameroon someday and carry out reports. And to all the other participants, I had to talk about the situation of journalists in the country at the moment, where many journalists cannot carry on their duties because they are scared of being intimidated, they are scared of being arrested by the government of Cameroon. And tell them that I have continued to stand tall, even with what the Australian authorities did. It didn't stop me from sending my message across, because I had to do a pre-recorded speech and send to those students who are really, really happy they could hear from me, but unfortunately, they couldn't have me there to get their questions answered.
How disappointed are you, Mimi?
When I see what just happened, it just reminds me of what I went through when I was in Cameroon and what journalists are going through in the country. These are countries under repressive regimes in Africa. Cameroon is one of them. But when we see that in Western democracies like Australia, then we begin to wonder what is going on. This is not just me. It's also about you, Michael. It's about any other journalist who would want to travel to any country, but being prevented from going there because they believe that you would go and you would not return.
I was speaking to my colleague, Mimi Mefotakambo. Eddie Micah, how do you feel about this?
Well, I will not say I can feel her shoes, but I can definitely understand the situation, because this happens quite often. Most Africans across the continent just want to travel for whichever purposes. In her case, very official. It's something that actually, as a journalist, would have been very good for her to go give that keynote speech and all of that, but just not being allowed. And sometimes the reasons given... You don't really get
it. Yeah, and in this case also, I think that's the sticking point here. The reasons given for denial, and mind you, this is the second denial in 2 months, and so it's a bit challenging when you don't really understand why you have been denied when you have all the documents that you need.
And normally the saying is that you go and you will not return, and I don't get that. I mean, we talk about open borders. People should be allowed to travel in and out of wherever, provided they have the right documents, and just explore or do whatever they are going to do, provided, of course, security measures are put in place. But some of the reasons not going to return, that's just...
Yeah, that's quite odd in this particular case. She lives in Germany.
Yeah.
She lives here in Bonn. She works
with
Deutsche Welle, so
yeah,
that wouldn't apply.
Yeah, it's all good. I'm sure Mimi is going to try again if such a conference or other important things come up, and we'll keep our fingers crossed and see how that goes.
Speaking out.
We are staying with the media for this part of the show. Media freedom is still a big challenge in Burundi. especially after the 2015 political crisis, during which most private media organizations were either destroyed or shut down.
The most recent case is the arrest on Tuesday of a team of journalists who had gone to cover clashes between gunmen and Burundian security forces. The journalists have been held for more than 48 hours with no charges or explanation. From Bujumbura, Burundi, Apollinaire Nyirora sent this report.
The team of four journalists and their driver working for the Iwachu Media Group is in police custody in Bubanza province after they were arrested in Musigati district, where they had gone to cover clashes between gunmen and Burundian defense and security forces. Here is Leandre Sikuyavuga, chief editor at Iwachu Media Group, where the FAV work.
On Tuesday, after receiving notifications via social media, we sent our team of journalists to verify the reports. However, once they reached there, they were arrested by police and taken into police custody in Bubanza. We called for their immediate release since they are our journalists and they were carrying out their duties.
After the 2015 crisis, journalists in Burundi have come under immense attacks. Most private media houses have been closed down and their reporters constantly harassed.
Currently, reporting in Burundi is not that easy because in most cases you have to sometimes censor yourself and see this story won't land you into problems or security issues. You have to take a lot of precautions while reporting in Burundi. And in the context of the ahead of the 2020 election, it's going to be a little bit tougher. But I think journalists have to adapt and see in different ways how we can adapt by the situation and report our stories objectively.
On the 25th of April 2015, the ruling political party in Burundi announced that the incumbent president Pierre Nkurunziza would run for a third term. The announcement sparked protests by those opposed to Nkurunziza seeking a third term in office. Widespread demonstrations in the then capital Bujumbura lasted for over 3 weeks. Since then, the government has adopted a heavy-handed approach towards dissenters.
Here in Burundi, journalists aren't free in exercising their profession. Reporters don't do it freely. Stories aren't done the way they should be done, but are done the way media bosses want them to be done. So exercising journalism in Burundi is challenging. You do stories the way they want the story to be oriented, and not the real story. Thus, there's no media freedom here.
So far, the deputy spokesman at the security ministry, Moise Nkurunziza, has remained tight-lipped on the reasons behind the arrest.
Apollinaire Nirora reporting.
So it appears that press freedom is still a major challenge across Africa, despite all the gains that have been made, Eddie.
Well, definitely. And I mean, it's good that you ended up saying the gains have been made, because some gains have been made consistently. Our country, Ghana, and so people listening will know we're both from Ghana. And Ghana has constantly ranked one of the best on the continent. Currently, number three when it comes to the continent. Namibia is one country that is also doing really good. But there's a lot of room for improvement, you know,
indeed.
Because I think sometimes people still struggle with the concept of why should a journalist be able to say whatever he or she wants to say. And I think that baffles me. The thing is, yes, we also have a responsibility as journalists, Michael, and that's also something we should take very seriously. Report accurate and only the facts.
I mean, that is very, very important. But also, I think that at the core of reporting the fact is access to information. Obviously. And across the continent, the right to information is still a major hurdle that most governments do not allow journalists to access the information that they need to do their jobs properly. And you mentioned Ghana, and that's why I'm bringing this up. We still haven't been able to pass a right to information bill, and that is a major impediment towards doing proper journalism in the country. And this is a problem that's also prevalent across other African countries, Eddie.
Definitely, Michael. Now, just to wrap up with some news briefs coming in. Thanks, Isaac Mugabe, for that. Mozambique's president and ruling Frelimo party are heading for overwhelming victories, according to preliminary results, as the opposition and some observers charge the elections were marked by intimidation. But of course, we'll be given updates when all these news stories develop. So it's been a show, Michael, hasn't it? Mainly focusing on journalism and freedom of journalists. But we'll keep our fingers crossed for positive stuff.
Yes. And we'll keep you updated. All the things that happens on the African continent, this is where you will get it.
Exactly. Well, thanks everybody for tuning in on Africa Link on our Facebook page, DW Africa. I am Eddie Micah Jr.
And I am Michael Oti. Have a good evening.
DW. Made for Minds.